kary, hledí tulák starý a na svoje mládí vzpomíná.
In 1947, at the age of 42, Edward Ingrish had already lived what most would call a full life. He was one of Czechoslovakia's foremost composers, with several hundred pieces to his name. He had been composing since he was 15 years old, and he was a rich man. His musical, The Capricious Mirror, enjoyed 1,600 performances in Prague, a record untouched even on Broadway. As it turns out, though, his life was just getting started. An instant hit from a musical, say, is not usually so instant that the audience stops the premiere, demanding to hear the song again. That was the case, however, with Ingrish's The Wistful Roar of the Niagara, first performed in 1932 in the operetta Tramp Love, and still to this day one of the Czechs' best-loved campfire songs, as Edward Ingrish's widow Nina knows very well.
I want somebody to be nice, and I say, do you know the song Teskne Hučí Niagara, the Niagara song? They say, of course, because since 1931, all the generations to the youngest one still sing it and still know it. And I said, that was my husband who composed it.
Ingrish is often unfairly forgotten as the author of the famous Niagara Melody, which many think is an old folk tune. Indeed, for all his success, it is not so much music that Edward Ingrish would come to be remembered for. The rise of communism in 1947 would set him on a new course into an uncharted new future.
After the war, they had a big meeting of the composers and the musicians, and of course a communist idiot came on, and he says this bourgeois type of music will now end and you will have to follow the Soviet Union type of thing. And he played them this Soviet popular songs. So they looked at each other and they said, my God, you know, this doesn't look good at all. His brother was in the military, and he told him, get out of here. In his diary, he wrote in 1944, and of course he didn't know that communism was coming yet in that time. He wrote, if this country ever becomes free again, I will fulfill my dream and I will go to South America and especially the Amazon.
The communists allowed him to take $50 out of his vast fortune to take a ship to South America, and he left with no idea in his mind that he would never see his homeland again.
He wanted to go to Argentina. He went off the ship in Rio de Janeiro. He couldn't miss Rio de Janeiro. Of course, he's an adventurous character. And, of course, then February 1948 came, and he lost his validity of the passport, and that was the end of it. He got stuck there.
A happy encounter with a Peruvian consul finally resulted in a visa in that country for the essential stateless Ingrish. But how to get there from Brazil? Well, by traveling the rivers 4,000 miles in canoes and rafts, hacking through the rainforest, befriending natives and headhunters, and documenting it all on camera.
Za naší vesnicí u rybníka rostou vrby, jo, rostou vrby.
For as it turned out, Edward Ingrish's greatest gift may not have been musical talent, but insatiable curiosity. And when coupled with a sharp sense of beauty and harmony and what can only be described as spunk, those qualities in his post-European life became the recipe for a great photographer. And in the end, the destination of Peru became not so much a place of residence as a base from which he could launch further expeditions into the jungle. He was attacked by a puma and declared dead, a fact he discovered on the front page of a newspaper in Lima, and Radio Free Europe aired a special on him in memoriam. He nearly did die in the jungle from a snake bite. He was also nearly forced to marry an Indian princess, as a chief wanted to trade her for his dachshund. His stories were endless, and they brought him great fame and encounters with interesting people, namely Norwegian scientist-cum-adventurer Thor Heyerdahl, who had recently been catapulted into fame by personally proving his theory that the Inca could have colonized Polynesia by crossing the Pacific Ocean in rafts.
Because he was such a famous photographer in Peru, he was recommended to Thor Heyerdahl. And Edward became enthusiastic when he told him about the raft voyage of the Kon-Tiki, you know. And so Thor Heyerdahl needed another crazy person who would prove his theory. And Edward said, I'll do it. He was ready to do it.
He called the raft Cantuta, after a flower that symbolized deathlessness to the Incas, and its first voyage stared death down and won. The group was caught in a whirlpool in the middle of the ocean for more than 6 weeks, grappling with starvation and madness, until miraculously rescued by an American warship.
He felt that he had ruined Thor Heyerdahl's theory, and that actually instead of helping Thor Heyerdahl prove it, he had ruined him. And everybody said, ha-ha, we told you so, that it's not possible, and so on. So he sold everything he had and put his own money into it because nobody wanted to help him on a second trip. They said, you're crazy. Why would anybody put money into your second trip, you know? And they didn't want to, so he financed it all by himself.
The second time, however, was a charm. After a four-month trip on which two crew members abandoned ship, murderously taking the water supply with them, the typhoon-battered raft sighted land. It was the last island the current could have taken them to before bringing them as skeletons to Australia. They left the ship and swam for shore, and in reaching it proved, again, that the world's greatest ocean could be crossed by raft.
They went into the center of the coral island, and then they built a little cabin there. And drank coconut milk and ate coconuts, and they caught some fish. And then one day they saw fires in the distance, some smoke. And then they said, goodness, according to the pilot book, this was uninhabited island. So they went to see what it is, and there were three natives. And the natives took them to the opposite side of the island where there was a whole village of them. So it was celebration. They went over to see the raft, and they had big festivities, and the chief gave them new Polynesian names. They could not remember them. I said, why didn't you write it in your diary? He says he forgot them. They were so complicated.
English had been a member of high society in Peru, not only for his jungle exploits and traversing the Pacific, but for conducting the National Symphony Orchestra. But his ties had been strengthening with America. A dawning adventure market in the United States created a lot of demand for his exotic photographs, and he began making travel films and directed a Hollywood film, Jungle Sabotage. It was he who Ernest Hemingway sought out for advice when filming The Old Man and the Sea, and he moved to America in the early 1960s and there spent the rest of his life, and there his immortality ran out at the age of 86. A decade later, his widow Nina moved back to her hometown of Brno, bringing with her over 1 ton of films, photographs, awards, and music that her husband left behind.
Between us, the binding thing was the music. I learned a lot from him. We did a lot together, and I miss him terribly.
Czechs are only now beginning to hear about Edward English, the adventurer, and really for all the colossal endeavors of his long life, perhaps it is still fitting that his homeland knows him best for that wistful roar of the Niagara, a song he wrote when he was only 19. Because perhaps with its beautiful artistry and wandering spirit, it encompasses the essence of him, and he goes on living Cantuta-like in the firelight of roving campers dreaming of strange worlds.